And we're live with our 327th episode of Absolute AppSec. I'm Ken Johnson at CK Tricky on social media, joined by my co-hosts, Seth Law at Seth Law on social media, and Kurt and Cameron. God, I'm going to say this wrong. I always mix up Chaos Coffee and ProdSec as Coffee, Chaos, and ProdSec, and I never know which one it is. So
I got terrible. All the words.
I'm awful. I did get all the words. Welcome to the show. And Seth has some words to say.
So Seth has some words to say. That could be the tagline of my life, right? Like, welcome to another episode, the crossover that we're doing this week again with Coffee, Chaos, and ProdSec. Cameron and Kurt are here. I'm really happy excited to dig in. We'll see how far we get today, right? We've got a lot of questions, a lot of things that we've been talking about topic-wise to review. Before we jump into it, though, a couple of announcements. Training number one, there are a few seats available still, both for Black Hat and for the DEF CON trainings. We talked last week a little bit about the differentiation between those two courses. If you are interested, please go back to episode 326 and take a listen. It's within the first 5 minutes of that show that we talk through what the difference in those courses are. Outside of that, obviously get ready for Hacker Summer Camp in general. Hacker Tracker has the updated DEF CON schedule. It just came out today. So if you are looking to plan out your DEF CON period, please do so. Take a look at Hacker Tracker to do that. And then finally, I do want to give a shout out to Guard Square for sponsoring today's episode. Think about your mobile app source code. Once it hits the app store, it's out in the wild. And without the right protection, decompiling it is easy for malicious actors looking to steal your IP or tamper with your software. That's where Guard Square comes in. GuardSquare provides the highest level of mobile app security for Android and iOS applications and SDKs. Their advanced tools integrate seamlessly into your CI/CD pipeline. We're talking polymorphic, multi-layered code hardening techniques and automated runtime application self-protection, paired with mobile application security testing and real-time threat modeling to deliver the highest level of mobile app security without compromise. Don't leave your hard work exposed. Secure your mobile application today. Go to guardsquare.com to learn more. So thanks again to GuardSquare. Those guys are pretty awesome. Like I said last week, I've been recommending ProGuard, their open source library, for a number of years to protect Android applications. They have other things available. So thanks for sponsoring. All right, let's dig into it. Kurt, Cameron, welcome to another episode. The second in our series. I'm happy to have you guys. Go ahead and say hi, and then we will dig in.
Hello.
Hey, thanks for having
Sweet.
Us.
Yeah, I know. That was an awkward transition. Thanks, Seth.
We got a lot of questions. I'm trying to be efficient here. You know,
we're trying to be efficient. We got a lot to get through. I think Cameron had a list of, he said 50, ends. And now it's got up to 60, 70, 80. 60. I don't know what it is.
I'm an over 100 by Friday. Right? I am literally an over preparer. Like, that is my curse. I just always have a billion. I want to make sure we have plenty to talk about, and we got to give the people what they want.
I'm the balance in this pairing. He'll over prepare, so I purposely just say, "Hey, Cameron, what questions do you want to talk about?"
Yeah, exactly. but the number one question, Cameron, we were talking pre-show, was how many pairs of Crocs and socks do you own, right? We'll start with, I guess I'll answer first. I have two pairs of Crocs, right? Not overly that many, but I do have to qualify that with, I have been a huge Birkenstock fan for a number of years. And so on top of the two pairs of Crocs, I have probably six pairs of Birkenstocks, I think, if I'm counting that right. And that is my go-to, right? Like, you know, footwear of choice. And so it you know, waffles between those two. So it could be Stocks and Crocs, or Stocks and socks, or Crocs and socks. You take your pick. No New Balances though, Ken. No New Balances. All right, Ken, how many Crocs and socks do you own?
I just got one pair, and I was giving you all the sweet preview of these. These are my Batman 1989 Batmobile Crocs that are rarely worn because they're so cool. But yes, they're only indoor Crocs. But yes, and I because I have self respect, don't wear Birkenstocks. And no, just no hate to Birkenstocks. Sorry,
that's a new trivia. Like
no, I feel like respect, so.
When the absolute AppSec trivia episode happens, that's definitely going to be one of the questions.
That will be one of the questions, exactly. All right, Kurt, how many pairs do you own?
I do not have a pair of Crocs to my name, unless you count my kid has like three or four pairs. And I mean, I guess I bought them for her, so I kind of own them. I don't know. I don't have any. I have like four or five pairs of flip flops because. Mm-hmm. I'm lazy, and that's an easy piece of footwear to put on at any given moment. So, yep.
I don't have any Crocs. So, tons of socks in general, different types of socks, nothing socks, exciting. Yeah. But yeah, and I wear Vans or like Converse all the time. So, they're easy to slip on and take off.
I've got some Vans. Yeah.
No so Crocs. Is this just a slight dig on like us being old and being concerned about like the basics and the dad topics of security? That's where we're going here. Is I asked this question so we can call you out on
anything.
Keep it to yourself. I mean, maybe this is the moment where we get a coffee chaos and process themed pair of Crocs.
Yeah, exactly.
Cameron wanted the coffee mug, so we made them, and
yeah, we got coffee mugs. Get some
maybe we got the background.
Is this an intervention then? Is that what's going on?
Might be. I mean, every episode you guys say Crocs and socks, and I'm like, what do they mean by Crocs and socks? Are they talking about
why
the
would
shoes?
You do that?
Or are they talking about what? Because it's so applicable everywhere, I feel. Every episode, you're like, you know, the Crocs and socks of AI, the Crocs and socks of SAS scanning.
Well, and actually, I'm glad you said that, because when this joke originated, this was a thing that really, like, older people were doing, like, bright white socks, like Crocs on, right? True. Then somehow it's you bring up a good point, because in the last few years, it's become, like, very cool for teenagers to do it. And so now it's almost... They stole our, hey, I got it. They stole our Riz.
I feel like, hello, fellow kids.
It's the rhyme, man. It rhymes. So everyone's like, that sounds cool. I'm in.
Well, I mean, they say fashion's circular, right? Like eventually what was in fashion comes back with a slight twist.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. What led to Crocs and socks, though? What came first? Was it the Birkenstocks, the stocks and socks? Seth started a thing and now it's here.
I mean, I think it was just making fun of Crocs at the time. And, you know, but we did happen to own a pair. And but the Birkenstocks.
Mainly it's because Seth always focuses on the very important, but, you know, not the things
boring
that
boring
like,
topics. Right? Yeah.
Yeah, they're not exciting. Like logging is not the most exciting thing unless like you're an incident or you've ever had to do some incident response or something like that. And it's like, oh gosh, I understand just exactly how important that is. Or, you know, there's like lots of things, authentication stuff like username enumeration is another one of those where, you know, it's just these like security hygiene kind of basics that Seth is always, and they're very important. And Seth's always kind of gone off on tangents about them. So, like I said, back in the day, shouting at the internet kind of thing, and
man yells at cloud situation.
Yeah, basically, it's our equivalent of man yells at cloud, right? Yeah.
That's my team tells me I'm that guy, so I'm with you, Seth.
All right, welcome to the club. You'll get a gray beard at some point, and it will be well earned.
When I can finally grow a decent one, I'll let you know.
Okay. All right. Let's see. Okay. So the first question, or the first topic, I guess we got the first question out of the way. But the first topic that came from Jerry as Cameron was posting in Slack about just things that people were interested to hear our take on actually goes to ASPM now. And he wanted to hear us tackle the ASPM consolidation debate. So I'll pose this question and let whoever jump in on it, and then I'll give my thoughts after that. So the industry is pushing hard for ASPM, Application Security Posture Management, to pull static testing, supply chain, and posture into one single pane of glass. So one place to actually look at all of these results. But is it actually reducing developer friction and solving underlying data quality issues, or is it just creating a more expensive dashboard for the exact same noise?
Yeah. I have strong feelings on this one.
Okay,
no, go Cameron. For it. Cameron's got to get it out of his system. So
I'm standing. I'm glad I'm standing for this question. Because I literally hate that Gartner merged, because originally ASPM was a separate platform or a SKU that was just like dashboards. It was originally like Defect Dojo, Armor Code, and these other, there's like Nucleus. There's a whole bunch of different platforms that were just data aggregators, dashboarders, Jira ticket creators, and slight automation deduping in the background kind of platforms. And for some reason, they combined that with actual scanning tools. And so now we have this ASPM, quote unquote, plethora of tools that is very confusing, because now you have vendors that are still only focused in dashboards, and then you have vendors who are folding in scanning, doing all the different things. You're seeing new and up and comers who are essentially bootstrapping a bunch of open source tools and saying they do ASPM, and they just have a fancy front end with a whole bunch of bootstrapped open source tools underneath the hood that they've just kind of loosely tucked in there. And then you have full-fledged platforms, actual companies, large, you know, the big names we know, that are actually delivering an ASPM platform, quote unquote. And it's very frustrating because the aggregation doesn't give you a clear on what we're doing and the whole point of an ASPM. And I'm a big fan of ASPMs. I love ASPMs, and I love ASPMs as a dashboarding separate tool, because in how I build my programs, I always go for best of breed. I want the tool. And by best in breed, I don't mean like your benchmarks. I mean my benchmarks, my company's benchmarks, my company's needs, my company's, my dev team needs, all these different things. That's what determines best in breed. It's not what the industry is saying. It's what is the most applicable and useful for me. And if you look at all the major ASPM platforms that do scanning, they all started out as maybe like SCA, or they were a SAS scanner. And then they bolted on, acquired something else, grabbed an open source something, cut their own fork, and started building out their own SKU and expanding, which means they're going to have really one good product and then a bunch of like mediocre attach-ons that are going to feel like, you know, janky, you know, combination Frankenstein platform. So that's where I feel that there's a lot of friction, because the tooling and the usability under the hood is not cohesive. So I look at ISPMs and I think they are extremely useful if done in the right way, which is you have one dashboard, all the tools hook in there. That dashboard has drill in points so that you can go from, you have a finding, it'll take you straight to the tool. It reduces noise, so the devs don't have to learn 10 different tools. They only have to learn one tool. And then the other side of it, which is the real power of an ASPM platform, is your reporting. You create a single dashboard that now you can give to executives. You can say, here is our product SKU, and here is our risk for that entire product, and boom, that's it, right? No questions, no nothing. It's a one page. It's simple. Maybe you curate the dashboards. You slice and dice the data how you want to and present it in whatever way. That is the power of it, because now you have one location, one set of data, one metrics. Everybody knows. You can bookmark it. You can add it. Like, I've had team where executives have put it on like their dashboards outside their office, and it's just sitting there showing. And when the vulnerabilities are spiking, they walk out and they're like, why is that spiking? you know, and that's where the power is. So I think with everything we do in ProdSec and AppSec and all these different fields, there's good and bad, and some bad approaches and some good approaches. So I think if done right, it does add a lot of value. If done wrong, as everything, it's going to add a lot of noise.
Okay. And I've got a couple of comments. Like, I wanted to call out a couple of things that you highlighted there. Number one is the customization per the organization that you are in. And this is, I'm with you here, because this is where it makes the most sense and where I've seen it done effectively. The problem that I run into from a consulting and like looking at all these different companies that I work with is a lot of organizations just don't have the engineering resources or the security buy-in or executive buy-in to actually build that customized. And so you end up with competing ASPM platforms because they've gone out and they've bought like three different vendors, you know, one for logging, right? Of course, right? One for, you know, SCA, one for DAST, and they all want to integrate and they have no central point. They have no time to do that. And so we end up with these like strange situations where developers don't realize that they need to go to the SCA tool, or they need to go to GitHub Advanced Security to see these results, or they need to go somewhere else because it's not in their stream, and vulnerabilities get ignored, right? Like that single pane of glass doesn't exist. And yet the vendors continually push the, hey, we want to be embedded in the org, so we're going to encourage you to integrate the other tools with us as opposed to the other way around. And it's hard for someone that's not in that like DevOps, DevSecOps space to actually do that integration. And so at least that's what I'm seeing, right? I love the idea, but to Jerry's point, I don't actually see it to like lowering that friction too much. And we're in the XKCD space of, hey, we have 14 dashboards. Why don't we create a 15th, right? And now we have 15 dashboards, and they none of them really cover everything that we need it to. And granted, it's a maturity problem, but
yeah, it's like it's a maturity problem, it's a cross communication problems. A lot of it sounds dysfunction. That's not only that. I bet there's a lot of other dysfunction. It's probably why, you know, you're working with them to reduce the dysfunction.
Yeah, I mean, it is. It is definitely a part of it. It's just like, I have a hard time seeing, you know, the forest through the trees, right, type thing, because it gets so down in the weeds. But Ken, I like, what's your experience there, right? Like, you guys obviously are, in that space at some point, right? Like, you're feeding in or whatever you want to say to those different dashboards.
Yeah, I mean, like, the one thing I was just sitting here thinking about is the, is it reducing developer friction? I don't know if like it was it meant to reduce. I mean, this is a genuine question. Like, is that really meant to reduce developer friction, or is it more a tool for, say, you know, you have a lot of alerts, a lot of noise. You don't know what to prioritize, what not to prioritize. Maybe you don't know or have like a good visibility into where risks lie in your org, but all those things like from a product perspective sound more geared towards the security persona than it does the developer. So I really mean that, like, I'm curious. I'm sorry I don't have a great answer, but I am curious, like, who's this solving thing for?
I think, like, to Cameron's point, like, put the developer in focus. I'm spoiled because I work with Cameron, so I get the benefit of, I can speak to what's happening much easier because I have a set of dashboards that I can refer to when I'm asked, or I can ask Cameron. But like, yes, it helps the security team. I mean, like, think about, go to the other side where I spend a lot of my time with CSPMs and CNAPs and the big platforms that are trying to invade this space, right? Like, they're not doing a great job either. They're just causing more confusion. But all the noise and all the stuff that you bring into that view, it's not helping me weed through it. And so it, with the ASPMs, at least the ones that I see Cameron prioritizing and the ones we're using, it does help simplify this because the way it's structured is like by product suite and component. And then I can click in, and if I need to jump out to Sneak or whatever SaaS tool is your favorite flavor of the week, it'll take me there and I can dive deeper. Now the developers get that simplified experience too, because otherwise they got to run their scan, they got to go to another tool, they got to log in, they got to figure it out. And then if they want to know what open source vulnerabilities they have, they got potentially go to a different tool, and it causes all kinds of additional friction. Whereas if you get the single pane of glass, it's easier to navigate. So from a user experience standpoint, I don't think it's so much a security versus dev question. I think it makes it easier for both of them.
Yeah, and I would like to define friction. What does friction even mean, right? Where is the friction point? Because friction could be at a lot of different locations. Where I see a lot of friction is if you're using multiple different tools, the devs then have to learn different tools. Like in my program, I'm running SaaS, SEA, infrastructure as code, secret scanner, a container scanner. We have pen tests. We have an API scanner. We have internal red teaming exercises that find findings, right? And so if I have all those findings in every single tool, the dev, how do they know that what their vulnerability skew is, right? How, what is their exposure? What are overdue? That's where a dashboarding ASPM platform will drive a lot of value for my teams, right? my dashboards and my ASPM tool, the number one audience and the number one user I can see by the logs and who's using it the most, it's all my devs. They go there, I build them custom dashboards, show them how to build their own custom dashboards, copy dashboards that are already pre-built and things like that. And they use that day in, day out. Like, it's part of their projects. It's like their stand-up. Here's our vulnerability status. They go through that. We have project meetings and they have their own internal ones. They're all using it left and right. I see them making their own dashboards. And with that, now they only have one place they have to go and everything's clickable, right? I make sure that if they need to go drill in further, it's all clickable and takes them straight to the tool. So they don't have to worry about that. And so that's where I think the friction is much less.
Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. Go ahead, Seth.
Go ahead. Oh, yeah. I was just going to make, go ahead. Is there a backlog? What were you asking?
No, that was the question. Is the backlog, so you know how like developers always have their sort of their Jira and their yep. GitHub projects or whatever their tracking is. So thinking about this, obviously you can aggregate from those sources into the meaning like pull from the dashboard. In this kind of a case, are they still using those project boards, or are they going purely for like let's say all of my non-security work items are in, I'm just going to use Jira as an example, and then all it would be then like, no, all my security stuff I only go to, whether or not it's even tracked in Jira, I'm just always going to go to that dashboard, not the Jira interface, just always going to go to whatever your ASPM vendor is and look there at that dashboard to decide how we prioritize mixing in these security bugs into our regular workflows for triage.
Devs will probably stay in Jira, right? Because all ASPM platforms create Jira tickets. My favorite part about most ASPM platforms is that they'll create the Jira tickets for you and it's a bi-directional integration, so it'll automatically close when they fix. But they also have templating, which is nice because you can build out the same format across every single tool. So when a dev gets a ticket, it feels, relatable, understood. It's not disorienting. Oh, this ticket's completely different from my container scan versus my SAS scan, right? It's all the same data structured and remediation guidance. All those things are structured in the same way. So I see majority of devs spend 90% of their time in the Jiras, which, you create Jiras. It's the managers, project managers, executives, like the leadership type that go into the ASPM platform, with some devs who actually prefer the ASPM platform, because usually you can tell what is coming to become more overdue. It's just maybe a little simpler for them. So I think with devs, you always give them options and they work the way that they want within their flow. But I think at the end of the day, you need some kind of Jira ticket because you need some kind of tracking in a formalized way that is in their normal workflow. And most companies use Jira.
Mm-hmm. The last question I have there is sort of about the two different ways. Like, so obviously you can set severity or your tools can set severity on, and usually that's typically, how one of the major factors of how things get prioritized in engineering work. I'm curious if there are any opinions on the other way. Cause I think it was Quiet with a WQW.
Yeah. IE. They were called Shift Left before.
Yeah,
I think they got trademarked or something. They couldn't trademark Shift Left.
Yeah.
So they switched.
No, I think you're right. And they got I think they got acquired too or something.
I think
like
so
that.
Too. Yeah. Really cool company. The first one that had like automation as the full cycle, right? From detection and remediation, I meant. From remediation. They had like from detection to remediation all in one platform.
Yeah, they also had exactly, and as part of that, they had like the this is why I'm bringing them up, because it's the first time I'd seen it, where they had like a button where you could click it. And then the idea was they were supposed to just kind of prioritize for you, that literally like get rid of the noise, quiet, right? And then automatically, assign risk. And I'm curious, assuming that I'm saying that correctly, like is that an approach you use, or does a human being still spend a decent amount of time reprioritizing things that get pulled into the ASPM,
We live in the day and age of AI enabled vulnerability research, right? You look at NVD and CVE counts, and we've already, you know, passed what last year was. We're on track to double. So if you're not automating, then something's wrong. I will say that probably every vendor is going to feed you some kind of like, the tube, like the shrinking tube where it goes like, you know, smaller and smaller. Funnel. Yeah, the funnel. God, I cannot think of that word. It drives me crazy. Every vendor I see is like, here's our funnel. And I'm like,
got the funnel.
All right,
another one.
What does your funnel do? But I think everybody's doing some kind of automation, and this kind of leads into the second part of the second question we wanted to cover. But a lot of the AI platforms will ingest or have modules that have threat intelligence feeds, and so they'll look and be scraping from multiple different feeds and show, hey, like this is part of Kev. This is here's the CVSS score. We're also seeing on the dark net these things. And I'm expecting a lot of these vendors too will start to integrate some kind of like AI exploitability model. That's what I'm expecting. The industry will head to like complexity. Like if a person had this amount of money, they could exploit this vulnerability because I don't know. How many tokens you got? How many tokens you got? Because that's the other thing. Like, how do we prioritize in this world? That's a question I wanted to talk about eventually. But how do you prioritize anything in a world where AI can just build your payload, right? We had Mook, mother of all Kevs, come out. Where you just drop the CVE and boom, and they build a payload. Doesn't work every time, but the concept is there, right? We are living in negative days in the sense that when a vulnerability is found, an exploit could be generated in seconds. How do you prioritize with all the tools? Is CVSS still good? Is Kev even still worth it? Kev is months behind. Are we supposed to use Vuln Checker? Either way, you have to do some kind of logic, something. My thought process is an impact analysis. I focus on impact. What are my most risky assets? And I prioritize the severity off that. If this asset were to get exposed, what customer impact would it have? That's the asset I want you to harden the hardest first. Yeah. And I'll try to drive in that direction because that's the world I live in, is that that's the asset that has the most risk. So, I don't know.
Well, and that's the question that I feel like I'm always trying to solve, or that clients for me as a third party are always asking is, okay, especially given the noise, and this goes to Jerry's second question here that I just posted as well, right? Defeating static noise with runtime context, like how do we actually deal with all the noise that's coming in from the AI world? Like if anything, like us as an organization, we're creating more noise because we're finding more vulnerabilities, we're finding more things, putting more noise into these reports. And so they want some sort of prioritization on top of that. And so I end up spending more time reporting and on kind of the basics, the crux and socks, right, of security. Always comes back, right? Like it does. Because like that's the prioritization that needs to happen. And that's to your point, Cameron, the impact. What is it that you can actually do with this, right? Yes, right? Like, okay, there's a severity score that popped out of CVSS and... right? Like, yes, it has like customer data that's in there, but it happens to be only available to admins on the internal network in this one specific portion of the dashboard when the role is elevated, right? Guess what? Like, that's not something that is critical that they need to go fix today when there is stuff that's out on the web that can be exploited by AI with, you know, a certain amount of token spend associated with it that may look on paper to be a lower severity, but ends up being a higher impact when it comes to the company in general. But having that discussion is not something that we generally get into that much. It's always like, oh, is it critical? Is it high? Is it whatever? It's not like, what is the impact that actually is associated with that vulnerability?
It's subjective, and you have to talk. I don't think there's a solid answer. It's you, your security organization, your CISO, all have to come together and go, what is my risk appetite? Mm-hmm. And then once you have your risk appetite, that's where it derives your prioritization. There's not one, we're not in a world anymore where it's you follow this pattern and that's your prioritization level. It's gone, right? You have to prioritize what is your company's risk appetite, and you have to sit down and figure out how do you derive that score to make it effective and automated.
Yeah. Well, and that's the challenge. Yeah, go ahead, Kurt.
Even with that runtime context, it's going to be subjective, right? Because it's going to depend on another set of tooling and how noisy is that one going to be. I won't name names because they all make a lot of noise. But at the end of the day, I think it comes back to what Cameron is saying, is that impact analysis, if it's informed by real runtime context, and that's what these major platforms are trying to do with like their attack path analysis, right? So we see some of them do it better than others and factor in that vulnerability information. And suddenly you have this view of what's exploitable, what's reachable, what's actually used because functions are called, or what's just a waste of space. Like, that's really useful context if you can weed through all the noise and actually leverage it to prioritize what is actually in use and what can be exploited because it's executing. But it's a really hard problem to solve. And again, it's going to depend on your tools, technology, time, resources, and therefore it's all subjective.
Well, and that's the struggle that I have when the clients come to me and they're like, well, what should we solve first? And my question is, well, don't you have a process to actually apply this severity of a vulnerability to your internal tooling? Because if you don't, that's another finding, right? Like, it's a process finding, but it's something else that we need to talk through. If you don't have a way to ingest this and make those prioritization decisions, because I don't want to pay the insurance for telling them to go fix vulnerability A over vulnerability B, right? And then they get, hacked by whatever vulnerability they didn't actually go fix on my advice, right? Like, and so it's always this like, well, what should we take care of? I'm like, from my perspective as a third party, you got to take care of all of them, right? But your risk appetite is what's going to come into play as far as, where do we turn first? What is the most impactful? And I don't always have a good view on that. Even if I have the code, especially those organizations where they don't want me talking that much to developers, or they won't give me access to a security architect or a software architect to actually answer those questions, I can't help, right? Small organizations is a little bit easier because you're usually talking to somebody that has some sort of sway, but the large ones, it's really difficult.
I think you need a t-shirt that just has a disclaimer on it that you wear everywhere so that you can give this advice and like try to help people. And it's like, hey man, it's there in your face.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
it's got to be a black shirt with white or green font so Cameron approves it.
Okay, there we go. I'll send it his direction first. It's gonna have a little logo with Crocs and socks on it though.
I was gonna say where's the Crocs and socks?
that's on the back. There's no space. That's for on it the back front.
Right there. Yeah we'll find some of those, right, for sure.
So it's the last thing they see when you walk away.
All
right. Second question.
Okay, yes, let's feed into that.
Was it Paul?
Yeah, I see David Linders in the comments from CISO of Contrast and a friend. What's up, David? How's it going, man? Hey. So he said the industry doesn't understand risk management versus vulnerability management. Yeah, I think that's fair. You know, it's risk, well, I don't know if the whole industry doesn't understand risk, but there, that just goes back to, I honestly think it's just like a vernacular issue. We just always have like terminology, methodology, like confusion. Everybody's got kind of their own way of thinking and speaking about things. It feels like
it's bananas. Well, I mean, now we have VulNOps now too, right? So like everybody's starting to push VulNOps, right? You have to no longer, it's not vuln management, because I don't know, were we ever managing our vulnerabilities? That's debatable. Risk? Is it risk VulNOps or something? I don't know.
Scops, VulNOps. Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, a lot of the language we use across the business is going to be like, we're addressing risk. As you say, vulnerabilities, developers understand what that is because they're constantly annoyed with you for bringing up more vulnerabilities. You go to like market to be like, what are you talking about? Or our customer is asking about a CVE. I get this one a lot.
Dude, like, Mythos. Yeah. Are you guys getting Mythos? I get those all the time. What are you doing about Mythos CVEs? And I'm like, what is that even?
I don't have access to that one.
I personally had to work on a response for Mythos stuff, so I totally get it. It is insane. That's a whole other topic I could rant about. And
I get a lot of those. What are you doing about Mythos CVEs? I'm like, do you have a list?
Like once a week. You're like, what are you doing about that? I'm like, do you have something that I don't?
What's your deal?
Still, we asked for access to it, but I don't have Mythos yet.
Why does it always come back to Mythos, guys? Yeah.
It comes
why
back
not GPT 5.6? Like, yeah. It's always Mythos.
Yeah, new. It, yeah. It,
that's in one of my questions. It's the harness. We can talk about that.
It, yeah.
Marketing.
It, oh, that's yes. The marketing and the AI platform. I know. I do want to talk about that, Cameron, too, because that is, it's fascinating to me. But all right. So I'm putting the next one in there, right? Because this does have, this does go to malicious packages and like the prioritization of what we're doing within ASPMs. This one's from Paul, 6mile on Slack, also one of the founders of open source malware. So it is relevant. But he wants us to, where we go? Man, I dropped it all in here and now I can't find. Okay, talk about the challenge of using one platform to address vulnerability software risk like CVE, OWASP Top 10, et cetera, versus intentionally malicious software risk. Right? Do we see this as a challenge? We're framing all of these vulnerabilities within the scope of one sort of ranking. Is that limiting what we actually do and what we actually address? Let's start there.
Yes. Next question.
Yes. How?
the Crocs and Socks.
I love how this is becoming.
You don't want to expound.
Justification.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think it's a difficult problem, especially if you separate like vulnerabilities and open source malware. It's a whole new SKU. It's a whole new attack vector, something that we have long forgotten, which most of these things are attacking dev systems, which if you look at all the vendors, there's so many vendors now have dev endpoint tools. Mm-hmm. I'm waiting for EDR tools to build their own, and we'll have a lot of competition in that space. In terms of like the news feeds, like I only know of really one good open source malware feed, and that is open source malware. There's not many other feeds that I know that are free, and I would say free. That's what I mean by that, because like you work in the SOC space, there's tons of open source feeds. There's tons of stuff you can ingest, and then you can ingest their premium feeds and things like that. This space is still just coming up to speed, and it's a whole new attack vector. So I don't know if anybody else wants to expand on that, but it's a good time.
Yeah, it is important. It is mentioning that, you know, like CVEs are, hey, we found a vulnerability in it and we've reported it, and you know, there's been a CVE issued, and yeah, we need to make sure that we update our libraries so they don't have vulnerabilities, right? May or may not be exploitable. But yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, having to call that out. So the difference with the malicious side is, listen, this is a package that has been exploited and uploaded and it's put into the wild specifically that so systems and people will download this purposefully compromised application that's going to do bad things once on your machine. And that's very, very different from, hey, this might have a thing that maybe someone can exploit, to like, this is purposefully malicious. If you download this, you're probably going to have some problems. Yeah. And so having those threat feeds where you can proactively respond to those things. Because I mean, you know, as much as I do, if you don't have good asset inventory, you had mentioned this for prioritization as your number one thing, Cameron. When you talked about impact, you're like, which of my assets matter the most, right? Which ones are the ones I'm concerned with? And so, people don't do a great job with asset management oftentimes. I think it's getting better, but so like just starting there, it's like, how do I know what's been compromised? How do I prioritize if I don't like doing my homework, if I don't know which of my assets are? No. So why I'm saying that is just to wrap that all up. I've talked about it a lot. I'll continue using ImageMagick as an example here, but at GitHub, We had Image Magic, it had RSE. And the way we did it is we just had to prioritize first the externally facing, who untrusted people can download or upload rather things that like images that could lead to RSE. That's the priority. The ones that were internal were a secondary thing to get to later, right? So anyways, that was a lot, but I do love that you called that out. Yeah, I'm curious, Kirk or Seth, do you have any?
Next follow-up statement here, right? Like, and I think this also, like, there's some nuance here as far as like what we're, how we're classifying and what feeds we're taking in, right? Like, so him saying pretty much all of AppSec uses a vulnerability risk lens to focus on malicious open source software. And I think that sets us up for failure because we're focusing on, you know, enumerating specific versions of packages that have vulnerabilities, but also malicious packages. Yeah. And vendors could miss things. And obviously we want multiple feeds so we get coverage, right, as far as what is actually malicious. But there is a difference, to his point, between malicious open source software that's been compromised and uploaded and actual like vulnerability data, Ken, what you're talking about, where, hey, there is something in the software that the developer missed that now needs to be updated, and we shouldn't be running packages that have known issues in them. Right? Those are two separate responses that we have as an industry, and we've never really separated that out. It's always been, hey, just go patch your stuff, right?
But we've never had that risk, like, at this level.
Yeah.
One leads to the other, though, too. Mm-hmm. Like, compromise the package, and then it's like, well, I've got to update to fix the vulnerability, and suddenly I pulled in malware, and it's like, oh, now I got a different problem.
Yeah.
But I mean, recently, like, they're the most recent NPM update I was reading about, and I know, I think Cameron posted about it the other day. It was like, they're trying to put things in place to combat this, right? So like one of the interesting things I saw of like, if the email on the account or the MFA gets changed, you get locked up for 72 hours. Like, talk about an arbitrary number, but that seems to be like how fast, or the kind of the long pole in the tent when it comes to actually issuing a fix. Like, it'll get fixed within 3 days, so wait those 3 days and then you're probably in the clear. But I mean, it's only a matter of time before someone finds a way around it, right?
Mm-hmm.
I forget what it, like, they were adding flags, or I think another one was cool, like, disable install scripts or disabled by default now.
Yeah, no more execution.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, like, that's great. But like, another solution I see, like, and obviously not everybody can do this, but some of the bigger shops, they use like commercial or open source solutions to just host their own package management. And typically it's commercial, so it's all managed and stuff, but you get this, like,
you can bypass those. Yeah. You can bypass all those, right?
Well, I'm sure there's probably.
Unless you're crafty with some very mature restrictions put in place.
Well, that's the problem with
a boatload of money.
That's the problem with
you can't bypass things. Like, I'm never gonna say that.
No, but what I'm saying is that, like, we have web application or we have a package firewalls, and then we have, like, you know, companies where they're, hey, you have to pull from Artifactory, right? The direct registry. Every time you do an NPM install, it defaults to the registry first. That's a config in NPM that is uploaded. A dev can go in there and boom, 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 done, right? And now it's pulling from the right one. It's literally like two lines of code. So the bypass is really quick. So is that the, like, yes, that's one control. How do you, as an operational side, because I've been exploring this, how do we operationalize, as you're saying, Ken, how do we do these different things? They can all be very easily bypassed from a dev, and we're in a world of AI agent coding. So now you just ask the AI to do it. AI is going to have full access to your local system. It's going to do it as you don't even have to understand where it is now. You just say, hey, it's going to this registry, change my config file to reach to the actual direct source. And now it's gone. My big problem, and this is what grinds my gears about all of this, is AppSec is becoming the SOC. We are the incident responders for all this. Our SOC peers have, usually every SOC person I talk to has zero interest in understanding what AppSec/ProdSec does. They're just all taught and really informed on the corporate side. And so then AppSec and ProdSec folks are becoming incident responders. And I'm like, this is a problem. the SOC folks need to step it up. You guys need to understand the risk exposure with compromises from all different angles, because that is a corporate level risk, which the SOC is usually much more focused on the corporate side. That, I don't know how you guys feel, but for me, it drives me bananas, literally bananas all the time, that like any kind of package, NPM, dev system compromise, I get the call at 2 a.m. because they're like, what risks do we have to worry about on the dev system? I'm like, what?
It's like they only have insight into so many things. I mean, the classic SecOps play is a monitoring system level stuff, right? And as soon as you layer in your first party software plus all your OSS libraries that are supporting that, they're like, what do we do? We don't have insight into that unless that malware starts behaving weird or the system starts behaving weird because of that malware. Then they're like, oh no. And then Cameron gets the call a little bit later. Mm-hmm. So it's like SecOps needs to expand their horizons beyond just the classic sense.
Okay. I'm going to go back to it, right? Like it's bananas to me that I'm still talking about logging and SOC stuff since that was the reason that Crocs and SOC came about, right? Like
There it is again.
Yeah. Yeah. There we go. So did I hit all of it? Yeah.
You got them all. I got them all.
No, but that's what I always thought. This was a discussion, like I'm talking like early on before I made the move into security. Like I was at iOmega and I was a developer, and I remember having these discussions about logging. What do we need to log from this new and fancy website, web ordering platform for the company, so that the SOC could monitor it? And to your point about the SOC needing to step up at that time, going in there and I'm like, hey, we have like application logs, and they're like, well, we don't really monitor those. We don't really care. I'm like, you don't really care. This is layer 7. This is where all the data lives, right? Like, you know,
this is being attacked.
Yeah, it's being attacked right now. We just had SQL injection. Someone took down the website, right? Like,
that sounds like your problem.
Yeah, and that's what it came back to. And so it was like, okay, guess what? You know, the developers, we've got a developer that's on call to answer those questions, because we don't know what this means when it looks like the website's down or there's a core dump or whatever it is that's actually happening in crash log, right? In the actual application logs, they were never trained to actually do that. And so, you know, and then the second that we would train up one of the SOC guys to do AppSec things, what would happen to them, or ProdSec things? Oh, they would join like the DevOps team or something else, because now they had skills that were needed elsewhere in the organization. It was a very, very difficult transition. And it's still a difficult transition. I mean, we haven't solved it.
Yeah. I'm looking at Bobby's.
Yeah, AI analyst now. So that's a top check. Okay, I'm sorry. I had to throw AI out.
Yeah. AI SOC, right? That solves everything. I was looking at Bobby's question or comment, and I was like, I agree. Right now we're saying the SOC needs to know everything. I'm saying the SOC has to know everything. I'm not saying every SOC individual has to know everything. What I'm saying is that you need a product incident response team, mm-hmm. right? And these are individuals within the SOC that are specialized on the product, not the corporate side, on the product. That's what I want. I want the SOC to have a true team in there that's focusing on the security of the incident response and monitoring of what's happening within the product. That usually defaults to product security teams, which we're inundated with scanning and a lot of these other things. We're not really actively monitoring what's happening in the moment. So,
is this coming? I saw a job posting the other day that was like, product incident response. It was like, what? Like, did Cameron write that? No. It was some obscure company I never heard of, but it came through like on LinkedIn, and I was like, great. Maybe we're finally headed in that direction, or that was just like someone's listening to the things that Cameron's been saying lately. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I found it interesting.
Ooh, Bobby's starting to bring up funding for those positions, yeah. right? Like, how do you actually yes, infrequent product. Product incidents have been infrequent in the past, but have we not in the last 6 months proven that, you know, Shai-Hulud,
Team PCP.
Say hello to, yeah, Team
Axios.
PCP. Yeah.
Extension issues.
That there needs to be somebody on that SOC that understands those issues and is able to quickly, yeah, quickly figure out what that blast radius looks like. Yeah. Yeah, typically fall under engineering incidents. He's, you know, he's absolutely right. Yeah, Zach's saying the same thing there. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know if there's a solution there. Wow, we have wandered quite far from what was the original question here, right? Like on.
I think we nailed it.
Yeah, we did. We definitely did, right?
Like, you know, so
well, actually I monitoring got, for those, but yeah.
I got a good question that I wanted to ask you guys. That we can ask here and not on ours. What is the next OWASP top 10? So I'll let Ken
the other
first.
Day.
I'll let Ken go first.
Oh my god. The next
it's OWASP. It's 10. A test. No, the episode's not out yet.
Well, I just need I'm getting ideas to make new to OWASP top 10s.
Yeah.
Cameron wants like 10 more projects, so
actually, if you can give me 2 seconds here, let me hold on. Give me
Claude, 1 second. What's the next OWASP top 10?
are you asking sure. What's on the OWASP top 10 or what the new list is going to focus on?
The new list is going to focus on. Yeah.
Ooh. Yeah. Like, if you give me just, I'm sorry, I'm just trying to find this, but we have some, basically we had some breakdown of, okay, we did a breakdown of what are by number, what are we seeing the most for agentic top 10. And I do believe, to answer your question succinctly, I think it'll be a combination of the traditional OWASP top 10 and the agentic top 10. I know that sounds weird. Ooh. Because yeah, mobile security had its own thing and kind of stayed its own top 10. But why I believe it's different is that, you know, we're building 4 applications and this is why I wanted to get the stats up. I'm going to just go off memory and I'm going to guess what we had. I know that prompt injections beat everything by like miles, like literally then it was like, I think 10,000 something prompt injections we've discovered versus something like, you know, 2000 tool mishandling, whatever that category is, flaw. So it is and that is like the second next, right? So then after that, it's like 800, 600. So 10,000 being like, obviously we find a ton more prompt injections than anything. My point being is that I would say that like out of the 10 that we've seen, probably is only, and we test for all of them, there's probably like 2 or 3 that seem to regularly crop up. And that's why I think like, why not pluck some of those out, put them into the OWASP top 10? I don't know. What do you guys think?
Yeah. I want to know what Seth's next top 10.
My next top 10. Now I'm being influenced by what Ken is saying there because I can see that. We had that discussion with Brian Glass about when is AI going to show up in the top 10. I know they try to be like more pragmatic about it. And I have to agree with the fact that the, you know, the core principles that they've started to migrate to there. And, you know, Brian's a gray beard like me. Like he's kind of sticking to those basics of what they keep. Yep, exactly what they keep in the top 10. So I feel like we have a predilection in security nowadays to just create top 10 lists whenever something new comes about, right? Like I'm pretty sure there's an MCP top 10 and a skills top 10. I don't think
agent
there is,
skills. But, there's agentic skills. Yes. Yep. There's LLM, yeah. There's machine learning, there's agentic, there's technically 5 AIs right now. And then if you include NHIs, there's 6 AI related ones.
Jeez. Which I mean, that's crazy to me, right? Like
there's over 20, you know, or there's over like almost 30 now top 10. There's maritime top 10. Like literally,
I was looking at this list earlier of all the OWASP projects and like counting the top 10s. And it's, I think it's almost 30.
So, okay. So in that case, the new list is going to be the top OWASP top 10 list.
Oh, it's top 10 of top 10.
The OWASP top 10.
It's going to be a meta list, right? Like what do you really need to be worried about? Right. And so I understand that, you know, the desire to create like security awareness around these issues. So if you're in maritime, I can see how the top 10 would be interesting there, right? Yep. Like, you know, whether or not we need an official list, that's where it starts to get questionable to me, right? Like, you know, but in general, they're necessary. I can see a like an SCA top 10. I don't know if there is one, right? Like, I could see that coming about, though, that they would create something on this is how you would need to, this is what your SCA program should be, or, you know, this is what your supply chain program should look like. These are the top 10 things that we were looking at. That feels realistic to me. And maybe there is one that's already been created, but that's not one that I've seen yet.
Ken, what are we looking at?
This is just, and thanks to Zach Fowler, who I work with for, he was listening and he to the podcast. Thank you, Zach. And he's like, hey, I've got these stats. So he sent them over. I was a little off here. You can see though, this is my whole point. It's like excessive privileges and prompt injection, like dominate. Prompt injection, for those that are listening, it says 12K. For excessive privileges, about 10K. But for the next set of categories down, it's like LLM tool misuse is 1,000. So that's a huge steep drop off between 10,000 and 1,000. And then below that is resource exhaustion at 800 and something. And the next two are far less, right? We're talking about 19 and 3. So that's why I was like trying to just show you some stats that kind of back up why I think like there will be some categories of things that fall out of agentic development, which is pretty much where most, you know, applications are going these days, that I think they're going to be so prevalent. And probably prompt injection. I can't even imagine. I don't know how that's going to, anyways, I don't know if that'll stay just because like there's a lot of kerfuffle on whether that's just how it's designed in OL or what, but anyways, yeah. I don't know. Yeah. Well, I have thoughts. I'm not going to go into them. So
cool.
Anyways, thought that was interesting.
Yeah. All right. So Kurt, Cameron, what are your, you know, new OWASP top 10 lists, I guess?
Do you want to go first? We had this discussion with Blake on Friday. So we're already like,
you're prime.
Ready. Different ideas, right? I'm trying to like think of new ones now to not just rehash.
I still want to rehash mine. You could think of new one. I'll rehash mine.
I think there were two that stood out that we had some fun talking about for me. Like Blake had a cool idea in the OWASP top 10 for like critical infrastructure, right? Like why haven't we've got one for boats for crying out loud. Why don't we have one for critical infrastructure? And then that spurred the idea of like, well, we're talking about autonomous vehicles and there are self-driving vehicles in the world. Like, is there going to be a top 10 for autonomous vehicles in the future? There's already one for drones. I did see that in the lists that I was looking at. And then the last thing that just hit my brain was AI coding agents. We see a top 10 for, we see eight AI top 10s for everything else, but we haven't seen one for coding agents. Or like, is that like, rolled into the eight agentic
like what
top
models
10?
or are you saying like, you know, hey, I feel like that's folded into the other AI ones.
Because I mean, take back to the statistics that Ken was showing, like excessive privileges. Identity problem. Identity shows up in like every top 10. There's not a top 10 for identity.
True. Why not? Good point. Yeah.
There's NHIs.
That's not, that's part of identity though. Like NHIs have problems. Human identities have problems. Agentic identities have problems. Like you could have a top 50 probably, but the list is 10. I don't know what the list would be, but it would be interesting to think about.
Yeah. Mine would be, and I mean, I'm rehashing the same one I said before, but it's because I actually believe it should be, is developer system risk. So the endpoint developer risk, because of all the attack vectors happening, I could imagine like excessive credentials, excessive permissions, you know, misuse of apps or untrusted applications, right? Like we could totally build out a set of 10 top risks that relate to a dev system.
I think that would be useful. Number one.
Yeah, access key. It would be useful, right? That'd be useful because we're seeing all these attack vectors. We're seeing all these things. I run the SPVS, and we just brought on Evan, and he's focused on dev endpoint risk and how can we build out a SKU of the SPVS because we have the dev systems in scope. What are all the risks, especially, you know, team PCP, all these attack vectors, NPMs, like major corporations are now, and companies and vendors are focusing on that and being like, how do we minimize the risk on the dev systems?
That's a man, that is such a tough one too. And I've seen the one thing I have seen is that I can't for reasons I can't tell you the vendor, but I got a preview of their portal, their new thing that they're building. And what they were doing was working with MDM developers to basically keep track of the AI coding agents you're using, and then track which MCP servers are connected to and what skills. Well, they're working on seeing what skills are in play on those AI agents. I don't think they had that in store, but yeah, there's definitely at least one product out there that I know of trying to go that direction to specifically secure that part of the development stack.
Yeah. I feel like just the fact that you're talking about, like I agree that this is a problem, right? Like, but if I go to my, like any of my, you know, especially clients that are not large organizations and say, hey, you should worry about the developer workstation, they're going to look at me like I'm crazy, because they don't. I mean, they don't even have,
we have EDR. Unique, aren't we? Okay.
Yeah, EDR, exactly. Right?
We have CrowdStrike. We paid for CrowdStrike. That's enough, right?
Oh. Like And until they push the prod without testing it, but
that's another top 10 list, right?
It's definitely an interesting attack vector and kind of risk that's exploding, right? I agree with you. It's all about it comes back to prioritization, right? What do we do? Where do we focus?
Yeah.
It's only going to keep being exploited. It's only going to increase. And eventually we're going to reach a threshold where it's going to have to be taken seriously. There's going to be whole product SKUs. There already are vendors who are new to the space and more coming. I'm just waiting for the compliance factor, right? The compliance or insurance will start to make this a mandatory risk factor that we have to monitor, and then it'll become prime time. So I predict the next 5 years, this will be a core application ProdSec SKU.
Yeah. I could definitely see it, right? Like, so Scott's asking, you know, do endpoint tools belong in the ASPM in that case, right? Like, I mean, it sounds like we're moving that direction. We've got to, you know, we've got to track that level of risk somewhere as well. And it is exploding.
The ASPM becoming the new SIM? Like, geez, what?
Well, no, I mean, I feel like we're having SIM, like, try to push into that market as well, right? Like, you know.
Yeah.
And honestly, if you look at it, right, like I would probably rather utilize that infrastructure and their experience in actually monitoring and alerting more than I would some Claude developed application that, you know, is now a SaaS product, right? Like, we could customize a lot of it, but they do give us that ability that we don't necessarily have through other spaces. So, I mean, SIM is definitely going to be in the discussion there.
Yeah.
You've got to meet the SOC where they're currently at, just like we have to meet developers where they're at. We have to like integrate with Jira. ASPM should be integrating with the SOC as well and with those SIM tools. Yeah.
Product security alerts to fire over to the SOC analysts.
Yep. No,
with a link. To build context.
Yeah. Yeah. See, there you go. We'll solve it all. It just takes a few hours and, you know, hundreds of questions from Cameron. Right.
Magic time, man.
I don't think it would take him hours for those questions. I think it would be very, very quick. Yeah.
I know we're running short on time, but there was kind of one last question that I wanted to ask you guys, you know, especially to really ground the state. But like, what do you think was the biggest AppSec, ProdSec event that happened, in your opinion, in Q2? So, I mean, a lot happened, right? We had Cloud Code Security, Team PCP, Axios, you know, a lot of new vendors coming into space, a lot of new product SKUs in space, all the different projects. We didn't talk about like Daybreak and Mytho, all those kinds of like big things that are happening and projects where they're trying to essentially fix open source. Like, I don't know. What was the big event that resonates for you in Q2?
I'll go first on this, right? Like, and as much as I'm tired of hearing about it, right? To me, the one that has the most influence has got to be the Mythos.
Crocs and socks, right? Of Q2.
That's
Q2.
Basically the Crocs and socks. Everything,
because everything is kind of spun out of that, right? Like whether it is Project Glasswing, whether it is like how well the other Frontier models do with security stuff, it leads to the discussions on, guess what? We don't need Mythos. We can build harnesses to do the same thing with open source software, right? Like, and so it pushed the discussion and the activity so far during Q2 that's what I've got to go back to is kind of the core there, right? Like, and it has, you know, it has roots in the slash code review stuff, but that's where I'm going to land. I don't know. Ken's thinking about it.
Kurt, you gotta think answer? Of a new. I gotta think of a new answer now because you just took mine.
The one I'm thinking about. I agree, and I'm pivoting off that one. But the big thing for me is all the projects that are coming out of that, right? Because mm-hmm. open source for me has been always just this frustrating thing. I remember years ago, I was sitting at it was after LastCon out here in Austin. It was like Jim Manico and a bunch of other influential AppSec people, speakers. I somehow got invited to the dinner. I was like, how am I here? I'm a nobody.
Not we were a all nobody.
About, at that time, much more. we were all talking about open source. And all of us were just debating. And like Jim was like, just give me like $2 billion and I'll hire a bunch of devs. And all we'll do every day is just fix open source nonstop. That's what we'll do. That's kind of what we're seeing today. It's a little different, mm-hmm. right? But now it's a lot of little organizations, a lot of different companies spitting out their own versions, but they're eventually contributing back to the open source that all of us can consume and use. I think that was like probably one for me, the biggest pivotal moment, because it's a community event coming together to solve a problem that I've never seen that we've all just talked about. And now there's action.
Cameron's going the positive route. Come on, Ken, like bring us back.
Make us sad again.
Make us sad. No, I mean, I actually, I could talk about, it'd be the same. It's just like, what are the things that have affected my world and what I see that would be different from maybe yours is that I was thinking about. For me, I think Fable and Mythos, while the model's not like, I don't, whatever, it does, it did do a few things. So for one, there were some immediate, so there were like the sanctions that were placed on Mythos and then, or on Fable, was that even Q2? Fable. Technically?
Fable. Yeah.
It was Q2.
Okay. Yeah. So if it counts. All right.
Feels
so
like it was there a were long time ago.
It does. Well, every day of my life feels like that. Anyways, moving past that, I would say that, there's the negativity. I would say like, okay, so for instance, Ben Gittins and Cole Cornford, right? We watched them go up on stage at a Clutch event. I think it was May or something like that. And they were talking about sort of like ways to build your own AI-backed tooling. And what's interesting is after this whole sanction thing, it's becoming clear that the US is trying to dominate a bit on the AI space, right? And that we have some foreign powers that were kind of like, there's some friction there. I'm bringing up Cole and I'm bringing up Ben because given that they're kind of like the AI AppSec, like vocal side of Australia, they're pointing out that like Australia needs to have its own plan for like AI strategy, for instance, when model access is lost and things of that nature. I think that's, so I don't know that like, it, I don't know impact wise, whatever, but from a geopolitical / cyber arms race perspective and everything that funnels out from there, there's a lot of little tendrils that spider out into different scenarios from that. For me, I think that sanctioning is actually the US government's reaction to Mythos and Fable is probably the thing I think might have some of the most impact in our world. So that's a very long-winded way of saying that, but yeah.
I'm thinking
and mostly about, if I'm being honest about Mythos in general and these models, I think it's just human beings' reactions to them. that's really what's driving pretty much everything. Are they capabilities? Sure. Are they perfect? No. Do they make a lot of mistakes? Does Mythos even? Yeah, sure. But it's not the story. The story is, how are human beings reacting if you're a buyer, an investor, a builder, whatever. So that's my take.
A lot of fear, uncertainty, and doubt, or the FUD lying around because of Mythos and now the rest of them. But I think about the tokenization aspect of this too, is like, everyone has now moved to that consumption-based model, right? And so now the questions around tokens, and people are getting their bills and like, oh, actually replacing humans with AI was maybe not the right decision. So that conversation is starting, which makes me think, have we finally gone past the peak of the hype cycle, and now we're kind of in that dip where it's a bit of dismay and overcorrection before this all levels out?
Yeah. Well, that's a good point. Like that.
I just want to throw this out, Seth. Sorry to interrupt, but I'm not really, because I got to tell you, I've felt that way several times. And then one of the big frontier models comes out with something, it's usually Anthropic, that's like going to scare everybody all over again, and it all starts up again. And I'm just like, have we not learned? Oh, I guess we haven't learned again. So hopefully, Cameron or Kurt, I hope that we learn from our reactions. But yeah, so far, I'm not as optimistic.
So far, the short-term history repeats itself.
Exactly.
I was going to go the other route. Like, the second that it becomes real and it starts to hit your pocketbook, right, that you're trying to do all this stuff with AI, that, I mean, Ken learned it early on because they were an early adopter in the AI side. So they had to figure out how to be more cost efficient with tokens and with token spend. Most organizations are just barely getting to that point, right? They're like, oh, if we just ask Claude, it's going to be great. And then all of a sudden, well, Claude just shut us down. Well, just, you know, just put some money in there, and then we can use those tokens, and we can just go, you know, per token spend instead of subscription. And then all of a sudden, yeah, that gets expensive really quickly, the more and more you try to do, you know. And so I do feel like we've crossed that for a lot of large organizations.
Yeah. And where I was, I guess, to round it out, where I was kind of going with that was, Q2 for me, it's like the start of the token conversation spurred this, hey, there's open source models that are just as capable and open weight models that if I run my own model locally, I don't have to worry about all that. Now I need to worry about the infrastructure and compute to back it. And so Q2 has kind of started this conversation, and we're seeing more adoption in that space. So what does this look like in the next 6, 12, 18 months? It'd be really interesting.
Yeah, we're actively moving off all. I mean, I don't even, like, I think we may have some usage still, but we're completely, if we're not completely off, we're going to soon be completely off them, to your point. It's a lot of things too. It's also like rate limits and compute and a lot of limitations. And so for a lot of reasons, it's just better to go to, and like GLM right now is really, sorry, I know this isn't the point. I'll wrap up, but GLM is really awesome too right now. So check out GLM if you can.
Yeah. That's a good, you know, I mean, you kind of connect the dots from what Mythos and Fable have done, right, to the cost, what we're talking about, to open source models, the open weight models, like Kurt, to your point, and where we're seeing it go. And, you know, with that, that's what I wanted to highlight now, though, is we'll continue that conversation on the Coffee, Chaos, and ProdSec podcast that is up and coming. We're recording that on Friday. Yeah, it will be interesting to get into that. So maybe we do predictions there on what Q3 brings. Yeah,
it's and
where this actually goes. So I'm sure that question will come about. That being said, I know we're pushing up against time. So appreciate y'all and all the conversation today. We are about right. I think we made it through 3 or 4 questions. We only have, you know, 55.
Five or six.
Okay. Yeah.
There'll be 10 more tomorrow. Don't worry.
Yeah. Don't worry. We'll replace those with others to address on an upcoming episode. I guess with that, join us, you know, next week, right? Like when that comes out. Otherwise, any final thoughts for today? Anything else you want to highlight before we go ahead and close it out? today. We'll just run around the room. Kurt?
I think I just gave my final thought. I'm out of coffee, so my brain is slowing down now.
Yeah, exactly.
Thanks for having us back. It's been a lot of fun, as always.
Yeah, it's been good.
I mean, we missed the most important question, what coffee are you drinking? So I'm drinking Mr. Bones. It's called White Rabbit. It's delicious.
I got the bones.
I still got the bones. I'm almost out of the bones. I'm trying to really get through the bones and get through that. No Mr. Brown
swap
today.
Out. I got new beans as of like yesterday. So I don't know. I'll have to save that for Friday. That's where we do the reveal.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I've got a Guatemalan that I'm like, this one's a light roast. That's pretty good that I'm getting through, right? Like, that's about done though. So I might have a new one for Friday as well.
Fingers crossed. I'm excited. Don't spoil it.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ken, any final thoughts? Any coffee recommendations? And then we'll go ahead and close it out.
Well, we're going to be on, we're going to do trading places here. So we'll record this week with the Coffee Chaos and ProdSec podcast. And then, so that should be coming out. And I remember something that you both had said before. I think you, when we were talking about this whole, like how to remember the order of Coffee Chaos and ProdSec, you said coffee always comes first. So finally remembered that.
Now,
finally, only took an hour and 16 minutes to remember that. But yeah, here we are. So anyways, thank you guys for coming on. That's what I really want to say. Thank you. You guys rock.
Yeah, thank you. I'm excited for the next quarter.
Yeah. So I'm always excited for the follow-up and for next quarter as well. All right. Well, thanks to Guard Square again for sponsoring today. And yeah, otherwise, join us in Slack and send an email to info@absoluteappsec.com if you need an invite there. Otherwise, we will see you all next week. Thanks so much.
And thanks again to Chain Guard as well.
Yep. Guard Square.
Guard Square. I'm an idiot. All right, guys. Edit that out. It's live. We can't. Whatever. All right. Later. Bye.
Bye.
All right.
Amazing.
Wrong button. I'm screwing this all up today, guys. I'm sorry.